Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17, to the first part of verse 21. The 14th talk in a series on Ephesians was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 21, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 10, translation, installment 8, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're going to continue in our study of the book of Ephesians. When we left off, we were right in the middle of the section where Paul is getting around to the main point of the whole work. And that, I would argue, is he wrote this work in order to basically address the question, so how should we live? What should we do? How should we conduct our lives, given that we have chosen, made a decision to be followers of Jesus and believe his gospel? Where do we go from here? What are we supposed to do? And this, it might have come as a surprise to us, but early on in the book, he doesn't really answer that question, or doesn't appear to be answering that question directly. What he does instead is he develops, for the first half of the letter, the book, he develops, he describes what it is that God is doing. What's God's agenda? What is his purpose in created reality? And what he reveals to us is that God's purpose is to pick out a people, choose, collect for himself a set of individuals who are going to one day be a part of the eternal people of God in the everlasting age that follows this one, in the coming age, the coming everlasting age. And that's what God is up to in this world. He's selecting out, culling out from the sea of humanity those individuals that he's determined are going to be his people, members of his people. So he spells that out, and then he finally gets to, what is it, about, I have it here in my notes, in 4:1. So in my translation, it would have been 17:1, or chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "Therefore I urge you, I, the prisoner because of the Lord, to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you have been called." So what is his answer? I would argue that's the central statement of his answer to the question, how should we conduct ourselves then? We should walk in a manner suited to the calling to which we have been called. And we looked at this earlier, the calling to which we have been called. We could even translate it to the appointment to which we have been appointed. That is, we've been appointed to a particular role that includes being appointed to a particular destiny. And God appointed us to that role and that destiny, so we should walk, conduct our lives in a manner that's consistent with who it is that God has made us to be by that assignment, by that appointment. And that's fundamentally his answer to the question. Now, again, he doesn't really answer the question the way we would expect him to answer the question, because we would think that somewhere along here he's going to tell us to be good. He's going to tell us to be righteous. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he spends several paragraphs telling us to respect God's purpose, to honor and respect God's purpose. And I'm going to now read, just because it's been a while, I'm going to read the passage up to the passage we're going to look at today. So 17:1, or chapter 4, verse 1, Therefore, I urge you, I, the prisoner because of the Lord, to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you have been called, with all lowliness of mind and lack of presumption, with long-suffering, putting up with one another out of love, strive earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit, based on the mutual bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, inasmuch as indeed you were called to one hope of your calling. There is one Lord, one belief, one baptism. There is one God and Father of all, He who is over all and to all and for all. So his right off the bat, his challenge, his exhortation is to respect the oneness of the body that God is creating. God is creating a body out of this eternal people that he wants, out of diverse individuals, people from all kinds of different background, languages, culture, times in history. You know, if you span all of history from Noah on or before, look at all the diverse individuals that God has picked out and decided to make his own and belong to him. Paul wants us to respect the oneness that God is creating by bringing all those diverse people together. And the main diversity that he has in mind is the diversity between Jew and Gentile. He's creating this people out of some Jews and out of a lot of Gentiles as well. It's not just the Jews, as one familiar with the Old Testament account might be inclined to think. It's not just Jews. He's going to include a lot of Gentiles in it as well. But they need to respect that God is committed to bringing both kinds of individuals into this group. Then he goes on in 18, "Now to each of us grace has been given in correspondence to the measure of the Messiah's gift to God. Hence it reads, when he ascended to the heights, he led captive a mass of captives, and he gave gifts consisting of men. Now this ascended, what does it suggest, if not that in fact he first descended into the lower parts of the land? The one who descended, the same one is also the one who ascended high above all the skies to the end that he might fill the all. Now, on the one hand, he gave apostles, and on the other hand, he gave prophets and evangelists and pastors, teachers, for the readying of the sanctified ones for the work of serving God. He gave such individuals to the end that the body of the Messiah might be established. They are to serve until we all obtain the one and only true belief, even the one and only true knowledge of the Son of God, the goal being that it become a full-grown man." Speaking with reference to the measure of the height of the pleroma of the Messiah. In order that we might no longer be infants who are tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of teaching, which is devised by the sophistry of men, by their cunning at deceitful trickery, we who are the all are to grow in relation to him who is the head, the Messiah, as we embrace the truth regarding his love. In relation to him, the whole body, as it is pieced and joined together through every contact that leads to an addition in accord with the measured activity of each individual part, causes the growth of the body into a building made up of itself for the acclaim of his love. Now, there's a lot there, and we looked at that in the past, but to sum it all up, what's the bottom line of everything he's saying there? The second thing he wants us to do is respect God's purpose in making this a body of people who have been united in one body by their relationship to the truth. So what are we to do? What is our calling? Our calling is to embrace the truth, and by embracing the truth, bringing others with us to embrace that same truth. So that's what we are to do. That then brings us to the second exhortation, and that's what we're going to look at today. The first exhortation was, what did I label it? To be what God has appointed you to be as a member of God's eternal people and fill the role that goes along with that. Now, finally, he gets to what we would expect Paul to say. And he gives us an exhortation to be righteous, an exhortation to righteous conduct. Now, this is a fairly long section. It's going to extend all the way from paragraph 21, which is chapter 4, verse 17, all the way down to it depends on how you look at it. At least to 520, and arguably all the way down to 6:9, paragraph 36, the end of 36. So this is a fairly long section, but it's made up of fairly brief points. And he just says this, he exhorts you to do this, and this, and this, and not that, and not that, and not that. But he starts off here by framing everything that he wants to say with respect to how we should live our lives, frame it in more general terms, and then he's going to give us a list of specific things that he wants us to either avoid or make sure that we do. So today we'll look at 21 and 22. I doubt if we'll get much beyond that, where he makes the more general point. In my translation, it reads like this. So this is in chapter 4, verse 17 in your normal Bible. So then, I will state and affirm this. As individuals who belong to the Lord, you are no longer to walk as the Gentiles walk in the unfruitfulness of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life offered by God because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart. These Gentiles, being beyond any sense of shame, have given themselves over to unrestrained sexual behavior such that in their pleonexia, and we'll explain that, they engage in every sort of sexually impure practice. But with regard to following the Messiah, this is not what you learned, if in fact you have given heed to him and have been taught by him. Such is the truth with regard to Jesus, that with reference to your former way of life, you take off the old person who in the nature of deceitful desires was proceeding to destruction and be made new in the spirit of your mind and clothe yourself with the new person, the one who, in accord with the purposes of God, is created for righteousness and a true devotion to God. Therefore, laying aside the lie, affirm the truth, each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Okay, you might want to pay attention to some significant differences in the way I translated that from your more typical English translation. And if I don't comment it, please bring it to my attention, and I'll be glad to explain why I went the way that I did. Okay, so the first exhortation was, be a member of the eternal people of God that God called you to be, fulfilling the role that God has given you to play. This exhortation is, be righteous, don't continue behaving unrighteously like you did in your former ignorance. Okay. He only uses the word righteous once, but I'm going to probably resort to it fairly regularly and continually as an encapsulation of what he wants from us. It's righteousness. He uses it in, where'd it go? 22:1 at the end of that, so it would be about 4:24, 23 or 24. Clothe yourself with the new person, the one who in accord with the purposes of God is created for righteousness and a true devotion to God. So that's where he uses the word. But this whole thing is really about righteousness. Now let me talk a minute about what I mean by righteousness or what I think the Bible means by righteousness. Righteousness is behaving in a way that God has willed you to behave. It's to be in the right. You know, when I act in such a way that I'm acting as I should act, I'm in the right in my behavior. But how do we define in the right? Or how do we define what it is that we should do? From a biblical perspective, it's pretty clear that we define what we should do by what it is that God has wanted us to do. How does he want a human being to behave? That's the right way to behave. Now, you know, for most of human history, I wouldn't have to discuss this and talk about this, but we have moved a long way away from defining the right or the ought in relationship to God. So in the culture that we live in and the way we, everybody around us, the way they talk, they are what philosophers would call consequentialists. How ought we to behave? We ought to behave in such a way that the consequences of our behavior end up being the best possible outcome defined in a particular kind of way. So we judge things by the consequences. In the social and political debate today, it's the only kind of argument that they will let you give. You can't go into politics and say, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this because God doesn't like it. God doesn't want us to do that. I'm not sure what's going to happen to you, but it ain't going to be pretty. But the fact of the matter is, even if our culture would not allow us to do that, that's the truth. That's what is actually the truth, is that what defines how I should act is what God wants me to do. And the reason that becomes an issue in our individual lives, I mean, leave the social political sphere aside, just in our own individual lives, if we grow accustomed to thinking in terms of, well, what are the consequences, we end up justifying all kinds of behavior by, I don't see what it hurts anybody. You know, if I do that, you know, who's going to be hurt by it? Nobody's getting hurt by it. It's no big deal. So that must be all right to do. That must be permissible if the consequences are not obviously harmful as I look at them. Well, that shouldn't be the way we believers, followers of Jesus, look at things. The issue is not, is anyone harmed by my action? The issue is, am I acting and conducting my life the way a human being ought to conduct his life as defined by how does God want me to conduct my life? It may seem like a subtle distinction to you, but there are moments in our life when that makes all the difference. And we need to be clear on what it means to conduct our lives righteously. Interestingly, in academic philosophy in the country today, several decades ago, a lot of evangelical Christians began to go into philosophy and get their PhD and become the professors. And it is interesting that there is a new theory of ethics that wasn't even around when I was in school called divine command ethics, which is a very unhappy title for it because it's very misleading, I think. But nonetheless, it has become a viable option that many young professional philosophers are arguing for, which is basically going back to a biblical account of ethics. So that's pretty interesting. But nobody listens to philosophers, so it's not going to have much of an impact on our culture. Okay, so in order to understand what Paul is doing here, we need to look at the historical context a little bit. Those of you who went to Israel on the trip that I was on, our guide, a Jew come to Israel many, many years earlier from Iraq. His ancestors had grown up in Iraq by way of India. He took us into the amphitheater in Caesarea on the Mediterranean Sea, and we were looking at the architecture, and we came to a point where he said, you see that room? You know what that room is? And he said, that's a vomitorium. they would, as part of their entertainment, you know, they'd be there for a play or for at an amphitheater, is probably some kind of artistic presentation of some kind. And they'd come there for the entertainment, but they would drink a lot of alcohol and eat a lot of food. And they and it'd get to a point where if you're going to drink or eat anything more, you're going to have to empty your stomach. So you would go to the vomitorium and vomit up everything that you had eaten up till now so that you'd have room to drink more and to eat more. It was systemic institutionalized bulimia, is what it was. And it was just absolutely culturally accepted by the whole culture. At another point, when we were not in that city, but in another city, we went through this building, which was basically a big, huge house of prostitution. That these houses of prostitution were a major part of the economy of these, and a major part of the social structure of the whole city. Everybody went to the house of prostitution. That's the context in which Paul is making the claim that he's making. What are the Gentiles of Paul's day doing? They're getting themselves blasted drunk. They are getting themselves sated on food. They are going to see prostitutes. They go to the games and see violent, vicious entertainment, you know, right on down the line. It was a completely decadent culture. And the point our guide was making is that was the huge distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles of that day. The Jews had as part of the Torah, God had taught them a kind of righteousness where you don't do that kind of thing. You don't live those kinds of lives. You live lives of restraint. You live lives within certain boundaries. Arguably, that's why we've run into this before in the book of Acts, for example. You have a lot of Gentile God-fearers. You remember that concept? Gentiles who, as their religious preference, have begun to go to the Jewish synagogue and hear the teaching in the synagogue, hear the teaching of Torah in the synagogue. Why? Because of the superior morality that they were learning in the synagogue as compared to anywhere else in the culture of that day. So create a mental image of Gentiles in Paul's day, and I think that'll give you a better sense of what Paul is saying here when he says, "So then I will state and affirm this, as individuals who belong to the Lord, you are no longer to walk as the Gentiles walk in the unfruitfulness of their mind." Saying, don't be living that kind of lifestyle. Okay. Now, to us, it may seem kind of obvious, maybe. But if you remember in 1 Corinthians, one of the questions that he had to take up is, well, how about going and seeing prostitutes? Is there any problem with that? I mean, it's just my body, right? I'm just using my body when I go to see a prostitute. It's not doing anything or affecting me in any way spiritually. So it shouldn't really make any difference. So these are ostensibly followers of Jesus who are frequenting the house of prostitution and justifying it by some kind of sophistry on their part. And Paul has to answer that by saying, you're thinking about this all wrong. Your body does not belong to the prostitute, it belongs to the Lord, he says. So this is a real problem in the time in which he's writing this letter. We may find it difficult to think that any believer would justify living like the Gentiles in Paul's day, but apparently there actually were some. And so Paul is having to say, so how should we live now? Well, not like them. We have to live completely different, radically different kinds of lives than they do. Okay, and notice then, just I'll dive into some of the details here in a second, but let's get a sense of the whole before we do that. Notice the last sentence in paragraph 21, that would be 4:21a, "But with regard to following the Messiah, this is not what you learned, if in fact you have given heed to him and have been taught by him." Why is he saying that? I think, again, think of that 1 Corinthians passage. There are actually people who believe that I can follow Jesus and yet pursue life as the Gentiles live their lives, and it won't have to make any difference in my lifestyle. Well, what Paul is trying to say is that's not what you learned when you learned what it means to be a disciple of the Messiah and to follow the Messiah. That's not what you learned, not if you were paying attention, not if you actually gave heed to what he taught. Then you wouldn't be thinking that that would be possible. So part of what he's doing here is to disabuse them of the notion that you can follow Jesus and live like a Gentile and be consistent with what Jesus taught. And he's saying, no, not if you were paying attention. Anyone who denies that that's what Jesus taught is a liar, and he's teaching a lie. That's going to come into play at the end of paragraph 22, where he says, "Therefore, laying aside the lie, affirm the truth." Now, I know most of your English translations make this an exhortation to not lie, period. But I think that misses Paul's whole point here. He's not doing that yet. He's not giving us individual instructions about principles of righteousness yet. He's finishing the point in 21 and 22. There are people out there who will lie to you and tell you that you can go on and conduct your life as the Gentiles do and still be a bona fide follower of Jesus. That's a lie, he's saying. So lay aside that lie and affirm the truth instead, each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. We'll look at that when we get there. Okay. So to sum it up, 21 and 22 taken together simply say, don't live like degenerate pagans in the Roman Empire. Not. How should we live now that we're followers of Jesus? Don't live like the degenerate Romans. How does that translate into our situation? Paul, I think, would clearly say, don't live like degenerate American unbelievers in the culture of 21st century America. Don't live like they do. Be distinct from all the people around you by seeking to practice a superior morality. Don't adopt a morality that adjusts and tries to conform to their morality. What they're doing and what they're saying and what they're thinking has nothing to do with you. We're on an entirely different path and an entirely different journey. Follow the morality that's appropriate to who God has appointed you to be. Adopt that morality and pursue that. And specifically, notice here, we haven't looked at it yet, except when I read through it, notice that the example he gives is sexual morality. It's the only example that he gives in these two paragraphs, is be distinct from the degenerate Roman culture sexually in Ephesians. Applied today, the same should apply to us. Be distinct from everyone else in our culture with regard to sexual morality. Increasingly, it seems to me, believers today appear to be adopting the attitude, if everyone else around me accepts a behavior as morally acceptable, then I'll accept that behavior. I might even practice that behavior. I'll certainly accept it, and I might even practice it. And that seems to be the trend of even Christians in Christian culture today. About 55 years ago, I can't believe it, about 55 years ago, some of us lived through the so-called sexual revolution in American culture, and we were teenagers or young adults when that was happening. Those of us who were believers would have considered it completely unacceptable, even in the midst of the sexual revolution. We would have found it completely unacceptable to move in and live with our boyfriend or girlfriend outside of marriage. Everyone else in the culture was doing that, but we wouldn't do that. We were followers of Jesus. We were disciples of Jesus. But today, it appears to become increasingly widely accepted by young Christian people to live together outside of marriage, before marriage. Paul would say such individuals are foolish, unthinking, ignorant products of their culture. They're just simply letting the culture shape them and mold them and make them one more member of the culture. There's nothing about their behavior that is consistent with that to which they have been called, if in fact they have been called. And the same thing that can be said for cohabitation apart from marriage, homosexuality, drug use, transgenderism, go right on down the line, the increasing acceptance and embracing of things that are completely incompatible with everything that we have been called to by God. I think our fear, I suppose that our fear is that if we adopt a much less permissive morality than the culture around us, in other words, if we don't become as permissive as the culture around us, then we're going to be odd and quaint to our peers, like the Amish. We don't want to look like the Amish. You know, talk funny, dress funny, you know, stand out in the crowd. You know, we don't want to be that. And we're so afraid of that that we literally adjust our morality to blend in more. Well, the fact is, we will look like odd and quaint to our culture. We will look like the Amish, but there's nothing wrong with that. In order to live in a manner consistent with our calling, we have to have the courage to appear odd and quaint to our culture. The Amish were never wrong to think that their lives should look different. They're not wrong about that. They're absolutely right about that. Now, they came to rather peculiar positions about in what way we should look different than our culture. But the fundamental insight or the fundamental impulse to go my own way and live a different morality and a different code than the English around us was a right impulse, and that should be ours. I will look odd. I will look as odd and queer as I need to look if that's what's necessary in order to pursue the path that I have been called to and appointed to and assigned to. It's going to get worse than being considered quaint and odd. We're going to be downright persecuted, undoubtedly. And that I'm sure that is right around the corner, I think. And we're going to have to muster the courage to face the hatred and the contempt and even the violence against us that may very well be coming. But in any event, we are called to pursue righteousness in every aspect of our lives, not just with respect to sexuality, but in every other aspect of our lives as well. And that's going to necessarily make us stand apart from everyone else in modern American culture. Okay, so I think that would be the message of these two paragraphs if Paul were speaking to us directly today. It would be very parallel to what he's saying to the Ephesians. So let's look at it bit by bit here. The first sentence, so then I will state and affirm this, as individuals who belong to the Lord. Now what does he mean there? As individuals who belong to that set of people whom Jesus has chosen to deliver from condemnation and take with him into the eternal kingdom of God. That's what it means to belong to the Lord. We are his people. And he's going to give us a particular destiny and a particular inheritance if we are his people. So that's what he's describing here. Now, most of your English translations, it translate it in the Lord, which is one very literal way to translate it, and attach it to what had preceded. I state and affirm in the Lord. But I think he's missing the whole, that translation misses the whole point. The whole point of the letter is, what should we be doing, we who belong to the Lord? How should we be living our lives? And so this exhortation begins with, as individuals who belong to the Lord, being in the Lord, what are we to do? You are no longer to walk as the Gentiles walk. I think that's the right way to understand that. We are no longer to walk as the Gentiles walk in the unfruitfulness of their mind. Okay, what does he mean by that? Well, a fruitful mind is a mind that gives you what you think you're supposed to get out of a mind. I mean, a fruitful tree is a tree that gives you the fruit that you're expecting that tree to give you. If it doesn't bear fruit, then it's not a fruitful tree. Or if it bears bad fruit that's of no use to you, it's not a fruitful tree. Well, God gave us minds, and he expected that our minds would deliver to us knowledge and understanding about reality. Knowledge and understanding of God and who God is. Knowledge and understanding of the reality that God created and the purpose of that reality in God's plans. Knowledge and understanding of humanity, what this creature, the human, is. Knowledge and understanding of myself. There's all kinds of knowledge we need to be rightly oriented to my existence here in this world. And I was given a mind to deliver to me the appropriate knowledge and understanding so that I can know what I need to know to be oriented to my life and existence in this world. But what if something goes wrong and my mind doesn't deliver to me true understanding and true knowledge of the things I need to know, God, created reality, myself, my purpose, and so on, then it has been unfruitful, right? Then it has not delivered what a mind is supposed to deliver. So it's been unproductive and unfruitful. That's the sense, I think, in which he's using it here. The Gentiles don't lack a mind. They're plenty intelligent. But something has gone haywire that makes it so their intelligence does not lead them to the truth. It leads them anywhere but the truth. Okay? So Paul is clearly linking their failure to grasp the truth is why they conduct their lives the way they do. They're conducting their lives as morally degenerate lives because they don't have a clue who they are. They don't have a clue what this world is that they're living in. They don't have a clue why they're here. And so they have no bearing for being able to make decisions about who should I be and how should I conduct my life. They can't figure it out. Okay, then he goes on. Oh, okay, before I go on. So how does he know that their mind is unfruitful? That their mind is not working. I mean, on the one hand, it could be as simple as, well, look at the way they're living. Their mind must be unfruitful because look at the way they're living. But I don't think that's what he's saying. Elsewhere, when Paul has the opportunity to address the issue, the unfruitfulness of the Gentile mind is always, the evidence of the unfruitfulness of the Gentile mind is their idol worship. You don't even know your creator. You haven't even figured out who gave you existence here. And you've made up all kinds of stories and myths and false gods. You've made a group of idols that you are worshiping. I know that your mind is not working, is not thinking straight, because of the conclusion you've come to about God. So no wonder, if your mind is that messed up and that haywire, no wonder you're coming to the conclusions that you're coming to that lead you to live the degenerate lives that you're living. Of course. But that's the unfruitfulness of their mind. It's evidenced first by their idolatry, but in this context, it leads to and results in their rampant unrighteousness. Okay, then he goes on, being darkened in their understanding, and I'm going to skip the parenthesis and come back to that, being darkened in their understanding, these Gentiles, being beyond any sense of shame, have given themselves over to unrestrained sexual desire. Okay, so what's he talking about? Being darkened in their understanding. The sense, first of all, the word that I've translated understanding, I think he's referring to an activity that we engage in, the activity of seeking to understand. We are darkened in our activity of seeking to understand. And the word for darkened, I think, in this context, would be better translated, you are put in the dark or caused to be in the dark. So in the midst of your activity of trying to understand, you are caused to be in the dark. They, the Gentiles, are caused to be in the dark. I mean, imagine you're in a room with the light on and you've lost something and you're searching the room for some item that you've lost. And somebody comes along and switches off the light. They've caused you to be in the darkness, but you're in the middle of searching for something. There's no way in the world you're going to find what you're looking for when someone has caused you to be in the dark. You're not going to be able to find it. Well, that's who the Gentiles are. They're thrown into the world along with the rest of mankind, and they have this task before them of finding the truth with respect to God and created reality and whatnot. That's the task of human existence, is to find that truth. But if we have been caused to be in the dark by something, it's hopeless. There's no way in the world that we're going to be able to find that truth. So the Gentiles, being caused to be in the dark in their searching for understanding, in their attempt at understanding, fail, of course. That's the source of the unfruitfulness of their mind. Let's see. All right, now let's back up to the parenthesis. We get a clue as to what it is that causes us to be in the dark, or causes them to be in the dark. Alienated from the life offered by God because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart. These Gentiles being beyond any sense of shame and so on. So, why are they darkened, put in the dark, cast into the dark in their quest for understanding? Because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart. Okay, what do I mean by that? Well, the heart here is parallel to the mind. He's talked about their mind being unfruitful. Well, their heart being hardened. The heart is simply their inner being, their insides, their, you know, what it is that makes them tick inside. Well, if I'm hardened inside, what I have done is become impenetrable to the truth. I'm not going to let the truth in. I don't want the truth to get in. I'm not interested in the truth, so I harden myself against it. I make myself impervious to it. And the Greek just says hardness, but I added the obdurate hardness, stubborn hardness, because that's clearly what he has in mind. Why am I impervious to the truth? Because I am stubbornly refusing to face it. I'm stubbornly refusing to receive it and let it in. It's that kind of hardness, which leads me to be ignorant. I'm alienated from the life offered by God because of not me, the Gentiles, life offered by God because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart. If I will not receive the truth, I do not receive the truth. And if I do not receive the truth, I am without knowledge and understanding. I am ignorant. So Paul is clearly laying the cause of this blindness and this darkness and so on their willful rejection of God's truth. And that, in turn, alienates them from the life offered by God. What he has in mind there is what we typically call eternal life. They are not in position to be granted eternal life by God as an act of mercy. Why? Because they have shown no receptivity to the truth. They have shut the truth out of their existence. They're idol worshippers, for goodness sakes. They have shut God out. They have refused to face the truth about God. And people who refuse to face the truth about God are not the kind of people who God is going to grant mercy and life to. So they're alienated, cut off, strangers to the eternal life that God offers. All right? So, being cast into the darkness in their quest for understanding, alienated from the life offered by God because of the ignorance that is in them. By the way, the kind of ignorance we're talking about here is culpable ignorance. If I'm ignorant because I refuse to know, then I'm culpable. If I'm ignorant because I have not had information even made available to me, I have no access to it, I've never even confronted it, I'm not culpable for that kind of ignorance. But this kind of ignorance, I'm culpable for. If I remain without knowledge and understanding because I don't want the truth, and I've rejected the truth, then I stand guilty. So cut off because of the ignorance that is in them on account of the obdurate hardness of their heart, these Gentiles, being beyond any sense of shame, have given themselves over to unrestrained sexual desire, such that in their pleonexia, they engage in every sort of sexually impure practice. Okay, he uses three words here, and these three words are often grouped together by Paul in various lists of evil, and they always come at the same part of the list. So although the words themselves don't have to apply to or be referring to sexual sins, Paul seems to always use them to apply to sexual sins. So that's the way I'm taking it here, because it fits the pattern of his usage. On the one hand, you have a word that they often translate it sensuality, but sensuality kind of doesn't really capture it. Usually the lexicons say unrestrained sexual desire, something like that. The point is, what's evil is that it's a sexual desire that I don't even seek to gain control over. I don't seek to govern it. I don't seek to restrain it in any way. I don't try to restrain my pursuit of gratifying the desire. I don't say no to myself. There's a desire, and I'm driven by the desire to act to gratify the desire. That's one Greek word that seems to indicate that kind of quality. And then he connects it with this word that I left untranslated, pleonexia. Now, most of your English translations throw greed in there somewhere, in your typical English translation here. That's because they're translating this word, pleonexia. But Paul always uses, no, I shouldn't say always. I don't know if that's true. Paul frequently uses pleonexia surrounded by a cluster of words that are describing sexual sin. So the more I've looked at it, I've become convinced that what makes pleonexia is not that it's greed, Greed is one example of pleonexia. The question is, what makes pleonexia pleonexia? I think pleonexia is a moral flaw that a person has where they are so willing to give themselves over to desire, no matter what it is. It might be sexual desire, it might be desire for power, it might be desire for possessions, and that's where you get greed, I think. It could be desire for anything, really. But if you are willing to give yourself over to desire to such an extent that there are literally no moral boundaries that you will not cross in order to get what you want. So what I have in mind are all those mobsters who, you know, I want to control the whole block here in Brooklyn or Queens or whatever. I want the whole block. And if somebody's in the way, then you just send out somebody to assassinate him and kill him. No big deal. He was in the way, right? So if you want to gratify your sexual desire so much that it doesn't make any difference what harm you might be doing to someone else, what wrong you might be doing in relation to someone else, then you are exhibiting pleonexia. You have no scruples. Nothing is pulling you back. Nothing is making you hesitate. Nothing is causing you to go, well, yeah, but that would be wrong. I can't do that. That would be wrong. So pleonexia is that moral flaw where you are immune to, you are blind to all moral boundaries. You just cross right over them without giving any thought to it. Whether it's in the pursuit of money, in which case it is greed, but in the case of sexuality, then you have rape, you have all kinds of perverse expressions of sexuality. You don't even ask the question, is it right to do? Is it appropriate? You just want what you want and you go for it. And that seems to be what he's describing here. So, put together, have given themselves over to unrestrained sexual desire such that in their such that with a complete disregard for moral boundaries in their self-absorbed pursuit of self-gratification, they engage in every sort of sexually impure practice. Okay, we're getting there. Maybe we're already there. I mean, I don't know. I don't get out much. But American culture is clearly collapsing morally to become very much like the Roman Empire of Paul's day in this regard. Being beyond any sense of shame. What does he mean by that? The word is just a word for being without feeling, and it depends on the context. I suppose it could range anywhere from apathy to something else, but the sense of it here, I think, is being without any feeling of what I would call guilt. I'd want to make a distinction between, not that that's what the words mean, shame is a fine word to use here, but if we distinguish between shame as some cultures know it, where you wouldn't want to be embarrassed in the eyes of other people, your village and so on, in a shame culture, that can be a powerful force on keeping you from doing things that you would otherwise do. But guilt, I'm using guilt to talk about shame in the eyes of God. It's not other people that we're concerned about. It's not being accepted by other people and approved of by other people. The question is, are we going to be accepted and approved by God? And is my behavior going to be acceptable to God? That's what we're talking about here. To have lost all sense of shame, I think, before God, they just know no moral boundaries. So he ends that paragraph, but with regard to following the Messiah, this is not what you learned, if in fact you have given heed to him and have been taught by him. And reading between the lines, I think he's saying, if in fact you really are a follower of Jesus, not just a phony, fake, inauthentic follower of Jesus, but if you are a genuine, authentic follower of Jesus, then you know good and well that you did not learn that you can practice what the Gentiles practice and be a follower of Jesus at the same time. Okay, we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to stop there and leave the next paragraph for next week and give you a chance to ask your questions or comments.
It is remarkable that sexual purity seems to be an indicator of righteousness or the attempt. I mean, it's just like night and day. People will say, well, that religion believes in X, and that's our X. That's like, you'll always be able to tell who they are because they don't do X, right? This is not an attempt to equivocate on it. So in different cultures, different things, different levels of, say, modesty are called for. And we would say it's not a decadent culture. But if modesty is a loincloth, then does the believer wear jeans? Or does the believer wear a loincloth?
A loincloth and a black hat, wide-rimmed hat.
Okay, cool.
No.
And there are...
I mean, to answer your question, no, I think it's fine to wear a loincloth if... See, all that... A lot of stuff is a matter of what it signals within that culture to people within that culture. And I don't think there's any problem with accommodating the culture in the sense of accommodating what is significant and what means what in a culture. It's the values of my values as a disciple should not be dictated by the culture. How I express them, that's fine. The culture can give me the context, the language to use to express and practice those particular values. That's fine. But the values themselves need to come not from the culture, but from God.
So two different groups. The people I work with all summer at the city have, this is part of their dress code, they have a rule. No cleavage in front, no cleavage in back. And that's how they settled that issue about how you dress or okay. How you wear your shirt or how low your pants can say, right? Now, you go into a high school and you make that rule, well, you'll get, you know, they'll have their lawyers on you. You can't dictate dress. Hmm. And kids today dress in ways that I would never imagine myself dressing. But they will tell you, that doesn't signal anything about my sexuality. I can expose as much of my body as I want. It doesn't mean I'm inviting you to touch my body.
Well, or see, that's where, okay. On the one hand, I said we can express our values in the language and the signs of the particular culture we're in. However, we have to be critical. We have to think critically about that. Some cultures just are already degenerate. And so it's not simply a matter of that doesn't mean anything. Of course it means something. It means that you have already become completely degenerate in your understanding of human sexuality to begin with. And I'm going to stand apart from that and have no part with that. I mean, I think that is certainly a valid thing for a Christian to do, if not even something that would be required of a Christian in certain contexts.
That's a huge discussion. I mean,
especially
for people today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I keep flashing on Paul's admonition that women dress modestly. I'm not picking on women here because I think men should dress modestly. But in our culture, even in our church culture, it's people make an effort. Men will make an effort to wear the Rolex, you know, the $1,000 suit, the handmade shoes to broadcast their success, right? Which is, I consider, ostentatious. I'm not going to take it. Someone will dress to show off their youth, their fitness, their desirability, or wear a lot of jewelry to say that, you know, I'm much desired and much adorned. Now, if you come into a church and you say, this is who we should be as Christians, we shouldn't be saying money defines me. We shouldn't be saying my physicality defines me. We should be, and then linking that to modesty, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what we're doing? Because that's what we're doing.
Well,
we should be doing.
This passage doesn't talk about that, but there are other passages where that's exactly what Paul says, or Peter in one case. Don't adorn yourself with jewelry, but with a gentle and quiet spirit. So, I mean, that critique is exactly in line with something that the apostles would give. I mean, there are times where all the practices of the culture are so far off that we just have to reject them. It's not a matter of learning how to live our values in the context of those. They're just wrong. They're just off. And that's where we're going to look weird and odd and quaint and different.
And the hard part is, if you're not living under the law and the rules, that's not clearly defined for you. And you have to really think through it.
Yeah.
You have to talk about it.
That's right.
You have to be open. You have to reason. And I just, how?
And you have to be looking at your culture and the world without something having turned the light off. You can't be cast into the darkness as you seek to understand your culture and the culture that you're living in. And that's the problem the Gentiles have, is that their own hearts shuts the light off, shuts the light out. So they have no way of really processing, of coming to any kind of true understanding of what's going on here in our culture. What's really going on in our culture? And is it something good and right? And should I have any part of it? But we should be different in that regard. We shouldn't be people where our hearts are turning the light off as we seek to understand and think about and analyze and critique our culture. We should be able to get to the heart of it and see exactly what's going on and know whether that's something I should have a part of or something I should stay away from and have no part of.
Jack, could you talk a little bit more about the darkening of the mind and how that works and how we can put ourselves in a position to fight against that? Because there's a number of ways in which I've heard you talk about it in terms of, you know, rationality not working, in terms of not thinking critically, in terms of, you know, their brain just not working. And I'd love for you to tease out a little bit more about, you know, like what is really going on in the mind when we look at out at the world and try to understand, you know, what's going on and what ought I to do, especially given that you can have, you know, two people whose minds work perfectly well and may be thinking critically about the same situation, but since they're starting from or since they are attracted to totally different principles, governing principles that start the whole thing off. Mm-hmm. You have one person who's looking at a situation and says, there's no God and the highest value is that, you know, we save the planet and, you know, therefore you're an obstacle to saving the planet and therefore, you know, you don't deserve to live. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, there's a God who is in control of all things and I need to bow to him and therefore I'm not in a position to judge you. Could you talk a little bit more about, you know, the mechanics of a mind being darkened and how that works and how we can...
Well, you have eloquently described one way, and that is because of my predilection to not like God, I gravitate toward and I'm attracted to a worldview and a set of underlying foundational assumptions and principles that is other than the truth. And often we're smart enough to know, if I accept that, I'm going to end up one day having to bow the knee to God, so I'm not going to accept that. I mean, we don't think that way. That's not our conscious thinking. But I think our minds, when they work at warp speed or hyperspeed, whatever, we're able to kind of sense, intuit the ramifications of certain beliefs. And so we find ourselves hostile to certain beliefs, and you go, what? Why are you so stubbornly resisting this thing? Well, ultimately, they're so stubbornly resisting that because ultimately, if you lead it to its logical conclusions, they're going to have to bow the knee to God, and that's what they really don't want to do. So at a logical level, what we're going to find is that they have false assumptions that they're doing their reasoning from. And so you have your set of assumptions that are informed by the truth of God. They have they're a set of assumptions that are not so informed. They're mutually incompatible, and there's no way that they can reach the true conclusion from any event or evidence or something that they're interpreting in reality. There's no way they can come up with a right interpretation of what we're looking at because they're starting from false premises. So I think that's probably the most frequent one. Occasionally you'll find people who literally exhibit it as stubbornness. They share my assumptions, they understand my assumptions, they can reason from my assumptions, and we get right up to, well, we should bow the knee to God. Nah, I don't think so. I don't think that follows. And they're just being stubborn. I mean, it's not, they're being irrational. Assuming the logic does lead you to you should bow the knee to God, that they're just being stubborn. That's another way to flick off the light. So I think there's a lot of different ways it happens, and it just depends on the individual. Most people are not intrepid enough to follow things to their logical conclusions right up to the brink of belief and then say no to God. Most people are too afraid of God to do that. So they start way back. I mean, I've had conversations where people, they won't accept the principle of non-contradiction. Really, you're going to make me argue with you about that? Some A and not A can both be true at the same time. Well, yeah, you're not going to end up a Christian if you start there. That's true. I mean, you're safe. You are really, really safe. But they just recognize that I'm going to keep a big buffer between me and the truth that I don't want to believe. Am I even addressing your question, or?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think there's just one way, though. I think there's a variety of ways that people do that. But maybe I'm assuming this. Maybe I haven't made this clear. It's never the case. Well, never. I shouldn't say never, but it's almost never the case that there's something wrong with somebody's mind. In fact, what they're doing is using a very, very, they're very intelligent, and they're mustering all of their intelligence to come up with a rationalization for why they're not going to believe. And they can do a great job. They can be brilliant in their rationalizations. So it's not that there's anything wrong with their mind. What's wrong is their heart. And the problem is there's an interplay between my mind and my heart. What I mean by that is there's an interplay between what I'm doing intellectually to try to think through my beliefs on the one hand and what I am willing to accept and willing to embrace. And that's not an intellectual issue, that's a moral, spiritual issue. So what happens is my moral problem sabotages my thinking. So it's not literally my mind sabotaging my thinking, it's my immorality sabotaging my intelligence.
So if I understand you correctly, if I find myself in a place in life where I'm mired in my own foolishness, and I recognize that I don't know which way is up right now in my life in this situation, that it's more likely that I ought to be looking at my own will to consider the truth or to do what's right, rather than looking at, you know, is my mind working? Are my logical faculties working?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Yeah, I think so. You can probably relate to this. I remember one incident in my life very clearly where I was watching myself rationalize. I had done something wrong, and I knew it was wrong, but I didn't want to call it wrong. I just absolutely refused to call it wrong. And maybe I'll take the time to tell the story. I might have told this story before, but it was my freshman year at Stanford. I had a freshman seminar with a Nobel Prize-winning physicist named William Shockley. He was the inventor, one of the co-inventors of the transistor, an old-fashioned technology. But he was the co-inventor of the transistor, and I dare say he was not a good man. He was arrogant. He was mean. He was not, and particularly when he got too much alcohol, and he would tend to drink a bunch of alcohol before the seminar. So he was kind of mean when we got to the class. And one day, I can't remember even what the topic was, but he was trying to explain some physical phenomenon, and we were all having trouble. And all of a sudden, so he was asking us to, so somebody explain this to me, explain back to me what I've just said. And I thought I had a flash of insight for a second. And so I started to explain my position, and he just was not getting my explanation. But another guy in the seminar who was also in my dorm, he thought he grasped what I was saying and got kind of excited. Okay, well, here's what's going on. And Shockley at one point said, Jack's not making any sense to me. Can anyone understand what Jack is saying? Yeah, I think I can. And so he started to explain my position. And I'm across the table going, yeah, you got me. You understood me. Yeah, right. Giving him all kinds of verbal feedback that he was understanding me. And when he was done, Shockley turned to him and said, "That was the stupidest thing that I've ever heard in my life." And I call him a friend, except I alienated him forever with this. But my dorm mate, I mean, you could just see his hands going out to me kind of plaintively, but will you share my embarrassment and my shame? And to my undying shame, I said, "Oh, no, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's what I was saying." That's bull. I was positive. That was exactly what I was saying. And I let him hang there. And the worst thing is, not that I did that. What's even worse than that is, as I was walking back to the dorm room, my mind was trying to convince myself that I really didn't understand whether he understood me or not. And I successfully stuffed that for years. It wasn't until, I don't know, maybe a decade ago, when I was finally, God had finally pulverized me enough that I was open and receptive to it, that all of a sudden my memory flashed back on that night, and I was horrified at what I had done, absolutely horrified. What am I saying? Oh, but I now I can remember quite keenly being of two minds. Me over here watching myself rationalize what I had just done, because I did not want to accept the awful truth about myself that I was capable of that kind of treachery. I didn't want to believe that about myself. And so I was going to find a way to not have to believe that about myself. But I watched myself do it. It was no secret. I just deliberately, willfully engaged in a process of trying to convince myself of what was not the case. And I somehow managed to convince myself enough that I could get comfortable with myself until God was found at time, Jack, we need to revisit something, no? Do you remember when you did that? And I just thank God. I was reading in an alumni book, this guy showed up. He wrote a little biographical thing about himself. And I just, praise be to God, he became a Christian eventually. No thanks to me. Because at the time, I was sort of a known spokesman for Christianity on campus. He knew what I represented. And that was what I always feared once I remembered what I had done, is that I had been the stumbling block that had kept him from the kingdom of God. And I was just very thankful to read that, no, he had become, through a fairly hard life, but he had become a believer eventually. So.
Thanks.
Enough about me. So we'll finish the second paragraph next week.